Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
It is Free for All Friday, and welcome to the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. What do you like listening to in your spare time? Maybe when you're driving home from work or you're doing chores around the house on Saturday? Music, maybe some podcasts. I'm sure this podcast is among them. I don't listen to this podcast. I've never listened to a whole episode, even though from time to time my wife will say, "Oh, do you want to listen to this episode you just did?" I say, "Oh, no, of course not." Because like almost everyone, I cannot stand the sound of my own voice. But one thing I do enjoy listening to from time to time are the Great Courses. They're a series of lectures put out by the Teaching Company, and it's a great way to be a lifelong learner and to grow in a lot of different areas of knowledge. And as an apologist, I find myself commenting on a wide array of fields where faith meets public life and culture. This can be involved in science or philosophy or history. So it's good for me to know about these things, and I just enjoy learning in general. And the Great Courses are a great way to learn about that. And for a while, I didn't listen to Great Courses because they can be expensive, especially if you get the DVDs or the videos. The audio actually isn't that bad. You can get 12, 18-hour courses for around $40, which I think is a pretty good deal. And by the way, I'm not sponsored by the Teaching Company or anything like that. In fact, I'm not sponsored by anybody. I am pretty sure I will never have sponsors for the Council of Trent podcast because I don't want to be beholden to them. Who knows, if I have Audible or I've got some other company that sponsors the podcast, one, I have to do those advertisements, and nobody really enjoys listening to them. And two, I wouldn't feel as comfortable critiquing something if it affected one of my sponsors. So I prefer just to have the support of the podcast come from viewers like you who have become premium subscribers at trenthornpodcast.com, where you can make a monthly donation that keeps the podcast going, and you get access to bonus content like our study series, the upcoming Trent Tracks, get a nifty t-shirt with my mug on it, or soon for future subscribers, a mug with my mug on it. So consider visiting trenthornpodcast.com to learn more about that. So what I wanted to share with you today was a topic from a great course that I've been listening to right now. And actually, you can listen to them for free on an app called Libby. So this is an app where you can download ebooks, audiobooks from your library onto your phone. So I found they don't have all the great courses on there, but they have a fair number of them. And so I was scrolling through about a week ago, looking at a new great course to download and listen to. And I saw one, an entire course on the Black Death, which is taught by Dorsey Armstrong. I believe she's a professor of medieval history, European history. And she's a wonderful professor, by the way. She has a great informal style about her. Anytime I have a professor who is not afraid to use the word like, you know, to say things like they were saying, being able to speak in an informal way without being distracting, of course, and using pop culture references like talking about the Black Death. She says that the Black Death in Europe reminded her of scenes in post-apocalyptic literature like The Walking Dead. So I saw a whole course just on the Black Death that took place between 1346 and 1353 across Europe and Asia. So I thought to myself, wow, 24 lectures just on this subject. Why not dive in? And so I figured, why not share with you a little bit of what I've learned from the course going through so far? And then if you're interested, you might want to pick it up yourself or dive deeper into history. I love studying history. A lot of people did not appreciate history. I know when I was growing up in school, math was probably my weakest subject, and history was my strongest subject. History was the one that I loved the most because I loved seeing the big story and seeing how all of the pieces come together to explain why the world is the way it is today. So when you see history and you get past just memorizing names and dates, because that's boring, when you see that throughout history, people, of course, they're all different, but we're all human beings deep down, and so we're similar more than we're different. And we see that when we study something like the Black Death. So what I want to go over here is just what I've learned by going through half of the course so far, and I think it should be edifying for you to grow in your knowledge. So first, this event that took place, this plague that swept across Europe and Asia from 1346 to 1353, at the time, it was actually not called the Black Death. The closest name that resembles that would be blue sickness, referring to discoloration on people's skin, but most people called it the Great Pestilence or the Great Mortality. It wasn't called the Black Death for centuries later. But ultimately, what happened is this plague spread throughout Europe during the 14th century is catastrophic. Estimates range anywhere from 75 million to 200 million people died. Europe's population was reduced by 30 to 60%. And the plague that spread across Europe was of three types. There was bubonic, pneumonic, and septicemic plague. So bubonic is when most people think of the Black Death and the plague, they think of bubonic plague, which, you know, there's a few cases of bubonic plague that still occur every year, even here in the United States. If you go out, and that's why in national parks and other places it says, do not feed the squirrels, because rodents, especially rats, or sometimes even squirrels and other rodent creatures, can carry bacterium like the plague. And so sometimes people get bit by these rats, these rodents, or fleas from these animals, contract onto human beings, and they receive the plague. But fortunately, now we have antibiotics, and the survivability of bubonic plague is about 90%. So some people still die from plague, especially if they're young or infirm or they're sick. But when treated with modern antibiotics, it's treatable. Although in the medieval world, the bubonic plague did have a 20% survival rate. There were chronicles from people who were afflicted with bubonic plague, and they actually survived to write about it and had just scars from the swelling that occurred. The name bubonic comes from, I think it's an Italian or Latin word, given to the growths on people's armpits and groins that came from the plague that were called buboes. Giovanni Boccaccio writes this. This is an early description of what bubonic plague was like. He said, "In men and women alike, it first betrayed itself by the emergence of certain tumors in the groin or armpits, some of which grew as large as an apple or an egg. From the two said parts of the body, this deadly gavacciolo," see, I've butchered English and French accents and all kinds of accents. I can butcher Italiano accents too. So it was a bubo, or in Italian, they called it a gavacciolo, soon began to propagate and spread itself in all directions indifferently. I'll try to keep things a bit lighthearted because I can't think of, there's only a few things in life more depressing than the Black Death. Maybe we'll do a whole free-for-all Friday on those. After which the form of the malady began to change. Black spots or livid making their appearance in many cases on the arm or the thigh or elsewhere, now few and large, now minute and numerous, as the gavacciolo had been and still was an infallible token of approaching death, such also were these spots on whomever they showed themselves. So that was bubonic plague, and it had, you know, a 20% survivability rate. It was the most common kind of the plague. There were two other kinds of plague that were almost always fatal for people, and that would be pneumonic plague. That involved a disease that got into your lungs. You would end up coughing blood and drowning on your own blood. You would die probably about, you know, 48 hours or so, no more than a few days. It was very painful, but very quick, whereas bubonic plague could be dragged out over a long period of time. So, you know, pick your poison. And then there was septicemic plague, a rare kind that dealt more with like blood poisoning. But of the pneumonic and septicemic kinds, these sorts of plague were so rapid. There are people who would be fine when they got up in the morning, would experience fever and headache and other like flu-like symptoms maybe around 9 a.m., and by lunchtime they had dropped dead. Chroniclers in the medieval world talked about how people were just falling down dead in the streets. Giovanni Boccaccio, who gives us one of these chronicles of the plague, he was also a well-known Italian playwright and author and poet, and a piece of literature that comes out of the plague that he wrote is called the Decameron. And this is an early example, actually, of a frame story. So it's funny, when you go back in history and you look at disasters or other things that happen in human history, things that are familiar to us now oftentimes emerge in very unfamiliar environments. So a frame story in literature is a story within a story. So when you see a movie or read a book and it starts with, well, the Princess Bride would be an example of that. You remember the beginning of Princess Bride. You have Fred Savage from Wonder Years, and he's sick. And then Columbo comes in, Peter Falk, And he says, I'm going to tell you this story. And you know, Fred Savage says, you know, is there kissing in this? It's a grown-up story. Ah, you'll like it. And so Princess Bride is a frame story. It's a story being told within a story. So Boccaccio, writing in the 14th century, wrote a book called The Decameron. It's a frame story about 10 nobles who went out into the countryside to avoid the plague. You see, as the plague spread throughout Europe, the only way you could avoid it was to quarantine yourself. The hardest hit areas were cities. These growing, they weren't metropolises, but they were packed, they were busy, and they were extremely unsanitary. So within cities, as the plague spread, close quarters made for, you know, unhappy accompaniments. So many people who survived were those who could flee into the countryside to ride the plague out. And the only people who could really do that were the nobles, people who had wealth, who had a chateau or a manor out in the countryside where they could hold themselves up. So the Decameron is a story about 10 nobles who go into the countryside to ride out the plague, and they tell a series of stories to pass the time. This framing device and kind of literature later inspired things like the Canterbury Tales by Chaucer. Now, back to the plague itself. The plague was discovered in the 19th century in an outbreak in China by Alexander Yersin, and the particular bacterium that causes plague was then named Yersinia pestis. Yersinia pestis was believed to spread the plague in Europe through fleas, particularly through fleas on black rats. So what happened was the fleas would feed on infected rats that were carrying Yersinia pestis bacterium. Fleas would feed on the rats, you know, suck their blood, but the blood had the plague bacterium in it, and this would cause indigestion in the fleas and blockage in their midguts. So you've got fleas that are getting actually really hungry because they can't absorb nutrients from their hosts. So they're biting more and more viciously, and then they vomit back up the blood, the infected blood in their bodies into a new host. So if they're eating on a plague-infested rat and the rats die, the fleas are super hungry, they're going to go to the next available host they can. And in many cases in 14th century Europe and Asia, those are human beings. Now, there are alternative theories. A minority of scholars think that the plague might have been caused by Yersinia pestis in some cases, but they argue that it wasn't the whole story. In a lot of other cases, it was tuberculosis. In the 1980s, Graham Twigg claimed that anthrax was the major force behind the plague, and that anthrax causes sores that are similar to what is described in plague accounts. And anthrax spores can remain active in areas for decades or even centuries, which would explain recurrences of the plague later on in history. Though for most scientists, the main conclusion of how plague was spread was through infected rats that carried with them fleas that later infected humans especially through trade routes. So what led to this in the 14th century? Two things. One would be the simultaneous rise of the merchant class, as well as a bout of poor weather and malnutrition in the population. So as we get into the 13th and 14th centuries, in medieval Europe, you had a three-tiered society. You had the peasant. Most people were peasants at the bottom. They were serfs that tilled the land, could keep a little bit for themselves, but mostly gave their produce to lords. Lords controlled the land and provided protection for the serfs and the peasants from Viking hordes, things like that. And then you had the priests and the laity. So as Armstrong talks about in the lecture, there are three groups of people: the people who worked, the people who prayed, and the people who fought. So the lords are the people that owned the land, but they were also responsible for fighting off invading threats. And so it was a very stratified society, and there wasn't a lot of mobility. If you were born a serf, you stayed a serf. You were born a nobleman, you stayed a nobleman. Now, how did people become priests and nuns, though? You're not born into that. Usually, those were the younger sons and daughters of the noblemen. So the ruling rich class gave all of their property to the eldest sons, because if they divided it up equally among their heirs, the plots would be too small and they would basically be worthless. So the younger sons and daughters ended up usually becoming priests or nuns because they couldn't be nobles and they didn't want to be serfs. But during this time, though, in the 14th century, Europe was emerging from a warming period. There was a warming period at the beginning of the second millennium, And because of this, there were harsh winters, shorter growing seasons. There was a lot of rain. A lot of chroniclers of the Black Plague were trying to figure out, well, what caused this? And they remembered that prior to the plague hitting them, there was incessant, nonstop rain. And so they thought that this was God saying, you guys are really in trouble now and I'm mad at you. When in actuality, the rain probably caused mold. It destroyed, made crops, crop yields very low. So people were hungry, they were sick, they were infirm, they were already weakened. And so they had a harder time fighting off plague and other diseases. But at the same time this was happening, you had the rise of the merchant class. As merchant traders became more effective, and especially in Venice and Florence and in Italy, were going to the east over the Silk Road, the people were becoming wealthier and were able to rise up out of the peasant class and sort of join up into the nobility class, sort of melding the two classes, that this fourth class of merchants started to rise in the 14th century. And so they established trading posts going eastward into Asia, if you remember Marco Polo and the Silk Road. Now, Italian merchants had purchased the city of Kaffa, which is on the Crimean Peninsula, located on the Black Sea. So it's in, you know, modern Georgia, Crimea, that Russian area, the Russian Federation. And so the Italian merchants purchased the city of Kaffa, which is now known today as the city of Feodosia, and used it as a trading post. It was a large walled city. But then in the 1340s, the mid-1340s, Kaffa was attacked by the Mongols. The Mongols laid siege to the city, but the plague probably emerged somewhere in China or Asia and started heading westward. And that makes sense because the 19th century plague discovered by Alexander Yersin was in China. So the Mongol army was just devastated by the plague, and people in Kaffa were riding out the siege and noticed what was happening with the plague. And so the Mongol leader of the army, in a last-ditch effort, took some of the dead bodies from his encampment that were plague-infested, loaded them into the trebuchets, and catapulted them over the walls of the city of Kaffa. This has been described as one of the first instances of germ warfare in the history of the world. Though, because people didn't understand germ theory back then, the Mongols were probably just trying to suck the fear, you know, stick the fear of God right into the citizens of Kaffa. But unbeknownst to them, the plague had now entered into the city walls because the rats that were carrying the plague were in the encampment with the Mongols. They're probably about a half mile away from the city. So they didn't make it through the stone walls. They were far away. This accelerated now, this wasn't the only thing, of course. There were other traders and other people moving through Europe. If the Mongols hadn't attacked Kaffa, the plague still would have hit Europe. But this was one of the things that accelerated it, because as the plague spread through the city of Kaffa here on the Black Sea, the traders there who had bought the city said, you know what, we've had enough. They got back in their ships and they headed back to Italy. Along the way, people were noticed that they started to become sick, but it was too late. They ended up docking in their ports. And this explains, when you look at a map of the plague, if you go to, for example, the Black Death Wikipedia page, there's a color-coded map that shows you where different parts of Europe were infected. And what's weird about it is you see early infections in Eurasia, in what is now modern Russia, and the last infections are in the Nordic countries, even though proximity-wise they're very close. It looks like the plague takes sort of a clockwise route around Europe. That's because it didn't just march across Europe just over land, just going west. It followed the trading routes. The trading routes are what accelerated the plague going through Europe, because these ships were taking things like wool, for example. Wool would have a lot of the fleas from the rats embedded in it. Then it gets into the cities and it spreads it. So the plague went clockwise around Europe, starting in a lot of port cities and then marching its way inward into different areas. And Italy, of course, was hit first hard by the plague. First hit hard, I should say. Agnola de Tura in Siena says this: they died by the hundreds both day and night, and all were thrown in ditches and covered with earth. And as soon as those ditches were filled, more were dug. And I, Agnola de Tura, buried my 5 children with my own hands. And so many died that all believed it was the end of the world. In fact, some historians at the time were writing about the plague, and at the end of their chronicles, they said, "And the plague then hit my fair village, and scores of people died, and then nothing. their chronicles are empty. They purposely left a single blank page at the end of their histories, hoping that somebody else would continue the story and praying that it truly was not the end of the world. And give you another gruesome detail here, that when people, eventually the church started to run out of consecrated ground to bury people in, one writer says that the dead in the mass graves were stacked and layered, bodies, dirt, were layered like cheese in lasagna. So I guess it's a very grim Italian way of describing what happened here. So what were the responses people had to the plague? Well, there's four different types of responses. Well, three to four. On the one hand, you had some people who thought that, you know what, it's the end of the world. I'm going to go out with a bang. And they engaged in hedonism, orgies. They said, forget it. It's the end of the world. Do what we're going to do. And they thought they would make merry. Some thought, though, that by making merry, it would attract good spirits or maybe turn things around without going full-blown hedonist. But many people engaged in hedonism. Other people engaged in flagellation. They would whip themselves to try to appease God. However, the Pope at the time, I believe it was Clement V, actually condemned the flagellators because they were encouraging people to think that it was truly the end of the world and that there, you know, it didn't matter what you did, so why not engage in hedonism? And finally, another common response to the plague was just indifference. Some people just said, you know what? Who cares? It's not who cares, but it almost just became a fact of life. Like, oh yeah, so-and-so died today. Oh, you know, it just became secondhand that people are dying and you just kind of carry on with life. Which, now to add a little bit of brevity to our discussion of the Black Plague, their indifference that people had is actually summarized fairly well in Monty Python and the Holy Grail. In the 1975 film Monty Python and the Holy Grail, in the scene, the not dead yet scene, because people did have to go out with carts to pick up the dead from houses to take them to these mass graves. And the way the medieval historians described it, people talked about, you know, the cart routines and, oh, I got to go over to the Johnsons, nine more dead today. Oh, yeah. And this kind of massive amount of death became sort of second nature. So to lighten the mood a little bit, we got to hear Monty Python, the not dead yet scene.
Bring out your dead! Bring out your dead!
Here's one.
Ninepence.
I'm not dead.
What?
Nothing. Here's your ninepence.
I'm not dead.
Here. He says he's not dead.
Yes, he is.
I'm not.
He isn't?
Well, he will be soon. He's very ill.
I'm getting better.
No, you're not. You'll be stone dead in a moment. Oh, I can't take him like that. It's against regulations.
I don't want to go on the cart.
Oh, don't be such a baby. I can't take him.
I feel fine.
Well, do us a favour.
I can't.
Well, can you hang around a couple of minutes? He won't be long.
No, I've got to go to Robinson's. They've lost nine today.
Well, when's your next run?
Thursday.
I think I'll go for a walk.
You're not fooling anyone, you know. Look, isn't there something you can do?
I feel happy.
Ah, oh, thanks very much.
Touch all.
See you on Thursday.
Right, all right.
And then that's, of course, the king going by, clopping the sounds of horse hooves, even though he's not on a horse. But actually, that indifference was pretty indicative of an attitude people had during the Black Death at that time. So what were some of the consequences of the Black Death on medieval society? Well, one thing, the Black Death hit the populations in varying degrees. The people that were hit the least were the nobles, as I described earlier. They had about a 20 to 30% death rate. So they were able to flee from it, but not all of them. People began to see that this was something that was indiscriminate, and even the royalty were not protected from it. A famous case of this in history is Joan of England. She was the daughter of Edward III. In 1348, she was betrothed to Peter of Castile, who was the son of Alfonso IX, who was the king of the Castilian kingdom, which makes up on the Iberian Peninsula most of what we would call modern-day Spain. Alfonso IX is also known as Alfonso IX, the Avenger, El Justificado. Edward III really wanted to consolidate England and grow its power, and he thought he had the perfect opportunity here by marrying his daughter, Joan, to Peter of Castile to unite the English kingdom and the Castilian kingdom. And things seemed to go well. In 1348, they set off with a fleet of ships. One ship was devoted to her dowry of all the goods and treasures that were part of the marriage arrangement. She had flowing dresses and tons of armed guards to protect her. She was the most protected woman in Europe in 1348. But for some reason, they decided to stop over in Bordeaux, France. And that region of France were actually English lands at the time. And in Bordeaux, the plague was hitting hard, and they didn't realize that they docked there. Joan was taken out to the countryside to get away from the plague, but that wasn't enough. She later succumbed to it. Writing, I think, from her father, a member of the court, says, "We have placed our trust," after her death, saying, "We have placed our trust in God and our life between his hands, where he held it closely through many dangers." However, as the nobles passed away, in some cases, entire wealthy families were wiped out. So what happened was people were drawing up wills now far more than they did in the past because death was such an imminent reality. And in doing so, they had no one to leave their lands and their estate to. So the lands and estate ended up going to the church or to the burgeoning guild association. So, you know, guilds, kind of like if you mixed a trade union with a fraternity, that was a guild. So guilds became wealthy and the church acquired a lot more land and property because wealthy families left their estates to the church because they had no one to leave it to. Also with the nobles, there was a land and animal surplus because when peasants died, if a peasant worker on your estate died, the family had to offer a tax to you in the form of an animal to make up for the lost labor. But now the nobles were overwhelmed with livestock that were given to them in the form of a tax because so many people were dying. They dumped the animals on the open market. This surplus actually drove down the cost of goods. The cost of goods and land plummeted in 14th century Europe, but the cost of labor went up a lot because the class that was hit the hardest were the peasant class. They had, in some cases, 80% mortality rates, and especially among peasants who were skilled laborers. So you had some unskilled farmers, but in 14th century, especially in England, you had a lot of specialized laborers. You had tanners, you had other kinds of metal workers, people who were specialized and made their living not by growing their own crop and subsistence farming, but through specialized labor that allowed them to acquire enough cash to buy all the food that they needed. But in some cases, these people would be wiped out. So the few remaining people who were skilled in labor, their wages went up 200, 300%. One unskilled labor that actually went up a ton in price. Who is an unskilled person you desperately need during the Black Plague? Gravediggers. They commanded extraordinarily high wages during the plague. And also, in the middle, you had the peasants were hit about 80%, in some cases, 60 to 80% mortality. Noblemen, 20 to 30%. Priests had about a 45 to 50% mortality rate. And actually, the plague did not help the reputation of the Catholic Church at this time for two reasons. One, people thought, you know, if God really cared about us, why is he allowing the priests and the bishops to die in so many large numbers? Why isn't God protecting his servants? But more than that, people's opinions of the church plummeted in the 14th century because the good priests got killed early on in the plague. So you have stories of people who desperately wanted last rites or wanted to be comforted by a priest, and the priests who survived the plague were usually those who were cowards who fled into the countryside and didn't administer the sacraments. The priests who were the good priests, the ones who served people and went out to help them, nearly all of them perished because they had intimate contact with people, especially those who had pneumatic plague. Someone coughed, then you would get that, or a flea would jump from that person's clothing as you're trying to minister rites and get on you and bite you, and then you would get that as well. So we're talking about the church during this time. This was a time in history in the 14th century when the papacy was not in Rome. This is during the Babylonian captivity of the papacy in Avignon, France. And Clement V was the pope at this time. And what's interesting was he commissioned a study to find out the cause of the plague. No one thought it was fleas. Germ theory was not discovered by this time. Most people thought there was something like an earthquake or an alignment of the planets that had caused bad air to form. Now, this is not that bad of a deduction to come to say that the plague had something to do with bad air. A lot of people in the Middle Ages thought that bad air could make you sick, and that makes sense, because if you're around garbage, if you're around things that can make you sick, like corpses or garbage or human waste, it's going to smell awful. And so that makes sense. And okay, so now this is correlation, not causation. It's not the bad smelling air that makes you sick. It's the stuff that causes the bad smelling air that makes you sick. So people thought that if you could get away from bad air, you would be well. So in some cases, one line of thought was if you could inundate yourself with other bad air, it would choke out the bad air of the plague. So people would stand around latrines and just breathe in the smell of urine, hoping to get away the bad air that brought with the plague. Other people thought that if you had good air around you, that would keep away the bad air. So go online today and Google medieval bird mask. Medieval bird mask. It's creepy. It's a weird mask that doctors and apothecaries and those who dealt with the sick would wear. It looks like goggles with a long beak in front of it. It looks like a weird vulture mask. And the reason they wore this mask was because in the beak, they would stuff a bunch of flowers and sweet-smelling things. So one, that helped them to minister and help people who were sick and lancing boils. And it was described that the smell from the buboes was so overwhelming, people would faint. So that would help keep them from fainting and was supposed to keep the bad air away. Ironically, it would operate like a surgeon's mask today in keeping them from expelling germs or from breathing in germs, acting as a filter. So one of the medical advices that was given to Clement V, his doctors told him he should stay in his room between two bonfires that would purify the air and burn away the bad air. And he ended up not contracting the plague because he was inside between these bonfires. The fire kept away the rats and the fleas that contracted the plague and kind of allowed him to be quarantined and isolated. One thing medieval people discovered was that quarantines helped. So they did discover that they would set up these health committees. That Florence, for example, set up a health committee to make sure the city was clean, that would quarantine visitors coming in and out as a way to prevent the spread of the plague. Eventually, of course, I haven't finished the course, but reading ahead and cheating, the plague burned itself out, but would come back in spurts every few decades or so throughout Europe, and then eventually died off as people's cleanliness improved. You didn't have as much open waste or rats as the rat population started to die out, as people built more stone structures rather than wooden structures, be able to keep the rats and the fleas away, and as people's health improved. One thing that's unfortunate that may have contributed to the Protestant Reformation about 160 years later, was there was a severe absence of priests and religious. They had been killed off. Well, there were bad ones that were left, the cowards, but the good ones died off in the plague. So people who were maybe not as qualified for the positions were hastily ordained. And so that led to untrained, illiterate priests who had concubines, who had wives, and something that needed reform. So that's why at the Council of Trent, after the Protestant Reformation, one of the major elements of the Council of Trent was the reforming of priestly formation, the establishment of seminaries, and making sure that qualified people were given the sacrament of holy orders. And one last thing that occurred as a consequence of the Black Death was that there were changes in art and architecture. And I'll end on a more lighthearted note. There are no more ugly babies in art. If you look at medieval art, most of the babies look like old men with male pattern baldness. Look up old baby medieval art. There's an article about it on Vox.com. It's really weird. Like, all the babies just look like little old men. Why is that? Well, because in medieval art, usually babies are usually the infant Jesus. And there is an idea, that, the homunculus theory, that Jesus became man, but he's fully formed. He's fully God and fully man. And another early idea in human development, human sperm would not be discovered until about 300 years later in the 17th century, that the human person was a fully formed, like a little man inside of the sperm, in the seed, the semen, and it kind of plants in the woman's body and grows and develops. So the idea is that Jesus is this fully formed man, fully God, fully man incarnate, and that's represented in art by showing him as an infant with the face of an old man. And so a lot of medieval art has this sort of expressionist quality, otherworldly quality. You know, it's very focused on describing what's happening in heaven. You have the painting of Raphael, for example, the Disputation of the Eucharist, where people are disputing in court about the Eucharist, and there's the heavenly court above them. But after the Black Death, people got pessimistic. They were more focused on realism in art. They wanted to paint things, nature landscapes, things that they saw all around them. They didn't want to paint about heaven and otherworldly things. They were much too focused in this life. And so a kind of realism ushered its way into artwork. And that rising merchant class I told you about became wealthy enough that they wanted their own paintings of their own families. And when they wanted paintings of themselves and their children, they didn't want their children to look like little old men. They wanted their children to look like the babies they actually looked like. So we see after the plague, as the Renaissance ushered in realism in art, the Gothic architecture, and a change in world history. Well, that was a short tidbit of world history for you all. Maybe I'll find another aspect of world history to give you a mini crash course on here in the future. I hope this was helpful to you. You had a fun end of the week here in the Council of Trent podcast. Be sure to check out TrentHornPodcast.com to support what we do. I hope you have a blessed day and a blessed weekend. Take care, everyone.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.